Okay, I'm going to get to the questions, guys. We might just have the picture at the bottom. This is Dr. Pimentel, and I don't care. Do you? I don't either. All right. I have several questions. On one of the slides, it showed other factors, including psychological. Do you remember that? So what are the psychological implications and factors of, you know, contributing to IBS and SIBO?
So it's complicated because anxiety and those sorts of factors at the time of the infection. Look, if you have a severe infection, are you anxious? Yes. You're more anxious the more severe it is. And so it's not clear whether the anxiety around the infection is because of the severity of the infection or because you have anxiety disorder. That has never been teased out. As far as I'm concerned, if you look at all the factors that are really strong, it has nothing to do with anxiety. It's to do with, did you bleed in the storm? Was diarrhea 10 times a day or 2 times a day? Were you in the hospital? Did you need intravenous fluids? You know, all of those things are much more important. And the psychological things are just because people were looking for psych all along that they continue to do that even in those trials.
Okay. So could stress be a factor? I mean, is stress impacting our microbiome and our SIBO and IBS that much?
It's an interesting, you know, I mean, I've speculated on this in another way previously where I said, you know, if you're under stress, the migrating motor complex or the cleaning waves of the gut are reduced. So maybe that puts you at risk for food poisoning. It's possible, and I've debated that, but there's no way to easily prove what I'm saying is correct. So I don't like to say it because I'm basically throwing out my opinion rather than some facts, but sometimes I think that might be the problem.
Okay, and then you were talking about the methanogens contributing to body mass. Can you cover that with us for a second?
Yeah, so that's a whole other kind of talk, but I'll summarize it is that, you know, hydrogen producers are the big group in the gut. So they're producing hydrogen, and as Ed mentioned, when the hydrogen level goes up in the gut, it inhibits those bacteria. It's sort of like they're pickling themselves. And so they stop eating and digesting because the hydrogen level's too high. And so it kind of contains them. Now the hydrogen producers are eating the lettuce and the salads and the material that humans can't digest. They're digesting them. They're helping get calories out of them. And so if you have a lot of hydrogen producers and they're eating all that material, then they die and they give you all that nutrient, that gives you more calories. But because the hydrogen producers are self-limited, they kind of like pickle themselves, they do it in a contained way. As soon as you add the methane's taking all the hydrogen away, and the hydrogen producers are firing through food much faster, much faster, much faster, and therefore they're liberating more short-chain fatty acids, more calories to you. And we've shown this in a number of studies. The second part of methane is it slows your gut down. More time to absorb, more nutrients, more calories. So the way I kind of summarize it, as I say, if you look at the back label of a bottle and it says 120 calories per serving, if you're methane, it's 130 or 140. It's just you get more calories out of something if you have methane and because the bugs help harness or harvest energy.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So Dr. William Salt is joining us today. He commonly sees discordance between the predominant predominant symptoms is diarrhea while the predominant gas is methane. Is that what you were just discussing? Is it methane constipation?
Yes. What Dr. Salt is referring to is that there are occasional patients where it doesn't make sense, meaning you have methane, but you're having diarrhea or you're flatline and you're constipated, and we see some of those. But with the new machine, we see those patients, and what we see is that the hydrogen sulfide is much higher than the methane is high. And so there's a battle, as I've said, and sometimes the hydrogen sulfide wins. On average, methane wins, but occasionally hydrogen sulfide wins in individual patients. And so that's why we need to know all three gases, because Dr. Salt can't figure out the patient because he's missing a gas. It's not his fault. I know Dr. Salt very well. So
yes.
Hi, Dr. Salt. When this new machine's out, it's going to be more interesting. You're going to get results that make more sense to your patients.
Okay. Can you comment also from Dr. Salt, and we'll get to everybody, I'm going to try. Can you comment on the clinical significance of a substantial baseline elevation of hydrogen on a lactulose breath test not attributed to poor prep?
Yeah. So I have to declare an error on my part, because I had always said high baseline equals poor prep. And I would send patients home, and then the next day we'd prep them better and we'd get a better baseline. But it didn't always happen that way. So the patient would argue with me, I did the prep, I did a promise, I bring them back, we do the prep again, still high baseline. So when we analyzed all 17,000 breath tests in our clinic, we actually found that in a good number of patients with high baseline, it did relate to more severe symptoms. So I proved that I was wrong, that it isn't always poor prep. It actually can be linked to symptoms. So my bad.
Well, oh my gosh, if that's the worst thing you ever do, I think you're fine.
But that's why science is important. Not everything that you can't use opinion, you have to use data to prove one thing or another. And we have to keep doing this so that we understand this, because, you know, you can't blame the patient. You got to figure out what's wrong. That's the way medicine should really be practiced.
It's a mystery. And that's why I call you one of the digestion detectives. Okay. This is where I go pretty fast, you guys. And I appear to be rude sometimes, but I'm not. I'm trying to get to as many questions as possible. And several people have asked about, can they get that hydrogen sulfide breath test done now, or where, or when, or how?
So the new machine is coming. I mean, we're hoping that it will be available just after the holidays, sort of like in the new year. So that's exciting, because it'll be available. Now, I can't say it's going to be available at your hospital, because, you know, it has to emerge and people have to get involved and buy it and do the kits, and it has to be adopted. But the device is fully validated. The device is validated clinically. So this is the only device that has been validated clinically. And the second part of it is, it's going to give you an algorithm, because we've actually figured out an algorithm of how to analyze the breath to predict symptoms. So it's more than just whether you're hydrogen sulfide or not. The stuff we haven't published is that we can predict algorithms on how patients, you know, might respond to therapy. We have a lot of different things that are going to be built into this, which will make it more user-friendly and better for patients so that they can get the best outcome possible. I'm really excited that this is coming up.
So will that test for hydrogen, methane, and hydrogen sulfide all at the same time?
Everything in one. Everything in one.
And is the prep going to be similar to what we've been doing?
Yes, the prep's the same. We use the same prep for the device, but the device internally in the components and the way it's built is completely different than anything that's out there.
Very cool. What about if you have high hydrogen, no methane, and constipation?
So that, we know those patients, and we know from our breath test and stool studies that there's a group of patients who have methane, who have methanogens in their stool, but it's greater than 10,000 per ml, but less than 1 million per ml. In that category, the methanogens are enough to make constipation, but not enough to show up on the breath test. So there's been a discussion about, should we do stool testing for methanogens in patients where the breath test, which is an easier test, is negative, but they're still constipated, to say, okay, look, your methanogens are elevated, but the methane isn't giving us the answer. And so we've debated that, and we're trying to figure out how many patients that is and if it's worth it. I can tell you it's really hard to get patients to bring stool in, and it's expensive to do PCR on stool for these organisms, but it is something that can be done. I mean, in the future.
Speaking of stool and stool tests, are stool tests a reliable and helpful tool in figuring out your IBS scenario?
So I've always argued that the colon is the trash bin. It's like saying, I know the people in the house, by searching their trash every week. So I'll see popular mechanics magazines, I'll see newspapers, and something circled on there because they're thinking about buying a lawnmower. So I may be able to figure a little bit out about who lives in the house. And that's what stool is, it's the trash. But if you really want to know what's going on in the house, go in the house. The house is the small bowel. And the small bowel is where all the action is. And we're in the midst right now, and some of you may be happy to know this, of a 10,000 patient trial, getting small bowel samples on all these patients. But more importantly, my lab, these brilliant people that you saw on this on the slide there, with a, except for that infant, he's not doing anything in my lab. We've worked out a methodology for getting the bacteria out of the sample. And I can't tell you more right now because we're publishing that, and that's going to be exciting because we can get 10 times more bacterial DNA out of our samples than typical aspirates, because we now know how to free them up for DNA extraction. And that was the problem. We were getting lousy. Everybody was getting lousy results because they didn't know how to actually handle the small bowel. So we worked on that. We've got 10,000 samples coming in over the course of the next few years. And we want to figure out what's going on in small bowel, because we think that's the key to unlock a lot of diseases and all the SIBO that we've been dealing with. So look forward to sharing those pieces of information as time goes by.
Ooh, fantastic. Tina, he answered your question. I'm going to confirm. Can you have methane and diarrhea?
Yeah, so the same question I answered with Dr. Yeah. Salt is that if you have that third gas, you might be able to figure that patient out. But right now, you can't. So you have to just assume.
Okay. Can you speak to the viability of a methane spot test with no prep? Are they accurate for methane?
So humans are either methane positive or not. So often the first sample shows methane and we're done. Now that's not going to be the case when the hydrogen sulfide comes out. So it's still going to be probably the breath test. But when we're looking at patients who are constipated, if you're coming up with constipation and you test just a single sample and your methane is positive, you can probably move on and treat it, because it's great certainty that the methane is the cause and you can just treat it out.
Okay. What about methane and GERD? There are a lot of people that have that combination. Is there a connection? And also, what if some people can't have prokinetics? That's a layer cake there.
So the problem with methane is that it slows the gut down. People tend to be more bloated. When we did a factor analysis, like looking at the cluster of symptoms and what cluster goes with methane, what cluster goes with hydrogen, what cluster goes with these different gases. With methane, the cluster is there is some reflux with there, and we think because it slows things down so much, the pressure builds up, and you get more bloating when you're methane because slows everything down. You can't clear the gases out. So you've got all this gas, but nothing's moving. So that's worse than if you have gas and you can at least relieve it. And that pressure can make GERD worse. I'm not saying that it's actually damaging the muscle of the valve or it's doing any of that. I think it's more a reflection of the distension that creates the pressure that causes reflux.
So Lorraine, I know you were frustrated with the internet. Remember, I don't run the internet, honey bunny. I can't test your flexibility because you were so amazing and you'll always be amazing. So please don't get frustrated with me. How do you measure whether the MMC is actually a problem? She has a client who has post-infectious SIBO, but she was not producing anti-CDTB. Also, she had methane, but was not, cut off, but you get the gist.
Yeah, so what we're learning with these antibodies is that it depends on who does them and all of that. So we're trying to centralize all this blood testing because there's a lot of people trying to duplicate it, replicate it, and it needs to be done right. So we don't know if that antibody is negative. We need to have the correct people do it in the correct way. That's a sideshow. But migrating motor complexes can only be measured by an invasive procedure of putting a tube in the small intestine and sitting there for 6 hours watching these patients with some sophisticated equipment. We do it. Mayo Clinic sometimes does it. There's other centers in California that do it, but it's not that many places, maybe 8 places in the United States.
So is there value to getting it done, or is it like just do the breath test and you can deduct about your migrating motor complex?
There's value in patients where nothing works, there's value. If you're getting good success with treatment, my goal is, and this is why I've showed you all the things I've showed you today, is make it easy for patients. Because they've gone through too much already and so many negative tests, the better I can do at not needing too many tests. And blood tests is easy. Tube tests for 6 hours, putting it through your nose, down into your stomach and your small bowel, that is not an easy test. Yeah. And you're awake, you don't get sedation. It's not an easy test. Believe me, I know these patients suffer with this. So I don't want to do it unless it's absolutely necessary. And there are patients where nothing's working and I need to figure out exactly what's going on, and I still do it. So we do maybe 40 a year out of all the patients we see.
Let's change gears a little bit. Oh, wait, I have one more methane question. Then we're going to change gears, guys, to treatment. Again, from Bill Salt, Dr. Bill Salt, who's one of our speakers, coming up on the 21st, this weekend. Anyway, while the colon is predominantly involved with the methanogen smithii bloom, how commonly is the small intestine included? Does methane bloom cause or contribute to gut epithelial permeability dysfunction, leaky gut, as does SIBO?
So the problem is methane hasn't been well studied in the small bowel. In the Greek study, I didn't show this data, but in the Greek study, 20% of patients in that study had M. smithii in the small bowel. Now, there's, again, two important things about that. Number one, nobody ever believed M. smithii could even exist in the small bowel. All the previous studies says it only exists in the left colon. That's wrong, because we found it in the small bowel in 20% of IBS patients. Second part of that analysis that we did was when it was there, it was larger in number than anything else combined. So when it blooms, it takes over. And now what we haven't done is that next piece that Dr. Salt's alluding to is, for example, leaky gut. One small thing we did find is that when the methanogens are there, when M. smithii is there, it's anti-inflammatory, anti-TNF. So TNF levels were reduced. Now, maybe that has implications in some diseases. Maybe, which goes back to some points I've made in previous conversations or webcasts, is I don't want to get rid of methanogens. I want to get them back in order, and because they may be beneficial in certain conditions, and we want them at a modest level, not eradicated.
Because it's part of a natural microbiome, a healthy microbiome.
We're not here to wipe it out. We're here to get it, to behave properly.
Okay, let's talk about rifaximin, everybody, and then we'll talk about, how do you pronounce, is it SYN10 or is it SYN10?
You could say it either way. SYN10.
Okay. So let's do this. SYN10, since SYN10 is created on the aspergillus, I'm not pronouncing that right, substrate, will this potentially feed candida?
So it's the extract. It's just the lovastatin. There's no aspergillus in there. And okay. So it should have no effect on candida or any of that. I will say one thing that we presented an oral presentation, which was a really boring oral, and I actually gave it at the big meeting, at the DDW meeting, that rifaximin does nothing to candida. And what I mean by that is before or after 2-3 treatments of rifaximin, there is no increase in candida in the stool, none. You don't get excessive candida from rifaximin. That was proven in a very large trial. So I'd like to settle that. That's a good news, because some people ask me, well, if you take rifaximin over and over again, are you going to get yeast? Are you going to get vaginal yeast infections? The answer from data we presented at this big meeting is, boring as it is, no.
Does it reduce candida by any chance?
The candida levels, there were sporadic patients with candida, and it didn't change whether they had it or not. It didn't reduce it. It didn't increase it. There weren't more patients with candida because of rifaximin. It just didn't affect it at all.
I literally have like 10 questions about this. What about the 25% or so of patients who never respond to rifaximin? What about the people who are on 7 courses of rifaximin?
Well, so let's address the 7 courses first. We published a paper that up to 6 treatments of rifaximin, if it works the first time, it works up to 6 treatments. We obviously now have patients who've done more. It works almost as well the first time, and we didn't see a deterioration to suggest resistance. Interestingly, there were some patients where they responded, wow, 80% the first time. They took it the second time, they got maybe 40%. They took it the third time, wow, 80%. So there's variability in response, and maybe the second time you took it, or the patient took it, they were a little laissez-faire with how they, you know, dosed it. Maybe they didn't take all the pills. Maybe they were just thinking, ah, it's just going to work magically and I'm not going to be so rigorous. Who knows? But if you take it rigorously, it's really going to work almost every time. So if you're saying 7 times and it doesn't work, that shouldn't be happening. I mean, if you take rifaximin and you get 0 response, don't take it again. It's not going to work. If you get a 30% response, it may be 80 the second time because you're getting the bacteria down and then down further. So I don't have a problem with that notion. But if you get 0% response, you need to move on and you need to figure out what's going on because it may not even be overgrowth. It may be something else. So in the patient, the first part of the question is if you take rifaximin or you don't respond, those are the patients I look for a lot of other things. So the way I would operate my clinic, if I was in the primary care GI setting, is get the blood test. That's what I would do. And then I would treat them first. And if they respond, there's nothing else that responds to rifaximin like that. Crohn's doesn't respond to rifaximin. Celiac doesn't respond to rifaximin like that. So it has to be IBS. And then I would proceed that way. If they have relapses or if rifaximin doesn't work at all, then that's the patient you're going to do the colonoscopy because your chance of finding something goes way up because now you're taking the patients who don't have overgrowth and you're looking for that are more sinister. So that's how I would do it.
Where can we go for the anti-CDTB and vinculin tests?
Well, stay tuned for that because I'll send it through you some information on the best way to get it. But give me a few weeks.
Oh my gosh, please, 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 especially because we're going to be doing the upcoming summit to, you know, tens of thousands of people coming in September.
Like everything else, like breath testing, like everything else, you got to do it right.
You have to do it right. So is there any other blood test we should ask for out in the world or just wait until that one's readily available?
Stay tuned.
Okay. I know somebody's asking here very persistently. A couple of questions. If Crohn's doesn't respond to rifaximin, what would you do? There's a whole different protocol for Crohn's, right?
Yeah, so there's some data from Europe that suggests that patients with Crohn's disease can respond. But let me kind of address that. So Crohn's does not go away with rifaximin. A subset of people with Crohn's disease, because Crohn's can cause strictures, Crohn's can be long segments of bowel that can cause stasis or fluid to build up, Crohn's can cause obstructions, adhesions, and so forth. So you get overgrowth very commonly in Crohn's disease, but it's due to the Crohn's. It's not the typical IBS. That's one part of Crohn's disease. And then rifaximin helps. I mean, it relieves the bloating and the distension and the symptoms and the overgrowth that occurs with Crohn's disease. Then there's another part of Crohn's disease where you happen to be that lucky person, 1 in 10 or 1 in 11, as I mentioned, that has Crohn's disease, but you also have IBS. And we think that the blood test helps there because when we say the IBS blood test isn't as sensitive, but it's very, very specific, it's because of these Crohn's patients. A very small few of them had positive blood tests, but they may not even, the blood test may be detecting IBS in Crohn's because 10% of everybody has IBS. So if you took those out, the blood test would be amazing. And so my point is the blood test may be helpful even there. But again, those patients do respond to rifaximin. And this is a final important point in Crohn's disease is that we see this a lot. Crohn's disease patient, they're on the Humira, they're on the anti-TNF, they get a scope. Oh, the Crohn's looks great. There's no inflammation, but they're still symptomatic. They probably have IBS-IBD overlap. That's the patient that I'm talking about that has IBS plus the Crohn's disease. Don't increase your steroids. Try to treat the overgrowth or treat the IBS, and maybe rifaximin is a good choice in that instance. So That's kind of how we do it, and I hope that's clear.
I hope that helps. What about your recent study on rifaximin and C. diff?
Right. So there are studies that compare even rifaximin to vancomycin in C. diff, and rifaximin and vancomycin are equal in terms of treatment of C. diff, which is why we hardly saw any C. diff in any of the trials with rifaximin. So the problem with that is that you can try it, but it's not FDA approved for that. It's FDA approved for traveler's diarrhea, for encephalopathy from liver disease, and for IBS only. But people do, of course, off-label. If the patient's sick and they need to try something because nothing else is working, then of course we do off-label sometimes for this.
Okay. People want to know when the lovastatin is going to be available.
That's the number one question I get in the clinic every week. And okay. I'll tell you, it's so frustrating. It's more to do with, you know, the company that has it has been done a great job. They need to get the money to do the big trial and to partner. And the drug is amazing. The clinical trial, the phase 2 trial was amazing. And it's been just frustrating for me and for patients to wait, to hope that, you know, there's some kind of arrangement so that the money is there to be able to do the phase 3 trials. Because to be honest with you, Sintin is a game changer. It is not another laxative. It's not another drug to just treat the symptom of constipation. It's treating the cause. And for some reason, I guess the investment community or whatever, they don't get it. And they think it's just another constipation drug. It's not. It's disruptive because it treats the cause.
Wow. Wow. Somebody's going to like really change the world and frankly make a lot of money if they will get that thing taken care of and out there.
Well, anyways, that's where it's at. And okay. I can tell you I'm frustrated every week.
I'm sure you are. Okay.
It's like you have something, you know, it's going to work and you can't use it. And because it's just it's at your fingertips, but it's not available.
So everybody who's listening to this, if you know anyone who's in the medical research world, the pharmaceutical world, let's get connected here. I'll see what I can do to help out there and get some important people connected. Okay. How much money do you need to get Sintin out? I like the way you're thinking, whoever's asked that question.
If you have $80 million, that okay. will be it.
All right. Okay.
That's two large clinical trials. That's how much it costs. It's ridiculous. Drug companies need a lot of money to get drugs across the line.
If you have reflux and methane.
You went off that topic really quickly.
I know, I did. What, the $80
million? It's a lot of money. No, yes,
too much. The back of my mind is still focusing on it. Don't worry. So we have someone who's really sounding quite desperate. I know we all feel desperate sometimes. Have reflux and methane not gone. She has reflux and methane. And the methane doesn't go away. It hasn't gone. And the prokinetics make the reflux worse. But I think it depends on what prokinetic you're on. What do you do and what can you do to get that methane gone allegedly or low or reflux bad, but all prokinetics make reflux worse. Okay, that's that on that. What do you think about that?
So it's a very sophisticated question. And it's the truth. In patients with methane or patients with reflux, if you take a prokinetic, it can make the reflux worse because what you're doing is basically causing the stomach to contract. And if it's contracting and the small bowel is not responding because of the methane, you're basically getting a hot stomach, more reflux.
Say that again. The internet jumped out.
If you get a high pressure, if you create high pressure in the stomach from a prokinetic because the stomach's now contracting, and the small bowel doesn't respond because of methane or whatever is going on, the motility of the small bowel, all you get is a pressurization in the stomach, and that will make more reflux. So what I would suggest, first of all, if you can treat the methane and get it down, that would be the first thing to do. The second thing is you really should take the prokinetic on an empty stomach at night, because if you take it on empty stomach at night, you get the migrating motor complexes, which are very forward moving and keep the gut clear. Don't go high dose prokinetic because high dose will make more pressure, low dose and facilitate the cleaning waves. That's how I would do it.
I know that hundreds of people just had an aha moment when you said that. Wow. Okay. I'm very glad I asked that. Let's just talk about rifaximin for another moment and about how it has such a high, people are calling it a relapse rate, but is the Xifaxan or the rifaximin really what's having the relapse rate, or is the patient having the relapse rate and the rifaximin is probably doing it its job and there could be adhesions or something else that keeps taking you back to a relapse?
Well, if I have a patient who relapses in 2 weeks, I got to start thinking of some other reason for the overgrowth. If they have a relapse in 6 months or 3 months, I treat them again and again and again, because I don't want to offer surgery for something that can be kept away medically. Because the problem is surgery begets more adhesions. The more you try to get rid of adhesions, sometimes they come back in the same spot, in the bad spot again. But if you have relapse in 2 weeks and it's adhesions, you gotta try to fix them. And we do. But you have to also, if you're going to fix adhesions, don't just go to somebody who does general surgery. You really should try to find somebody who knows what they're doing with this. And we have some super expert colorectal surgeons who deal with adhesions all the time, and they know how to handle them, and they put the right material in there to try and prevent adhesions from coming back. And so there's experts who do this in a good way.
Okay. Let me, Nancy, he already answered that question. So I'm going to let you re-listen to the tape. When rifaximin isn't working, okay, and they really don't think that it's something else, is that even possible? What is an alternative treatment for SIBO? There are the herbs. What else do you do? Or are you like, that's not really what you should be thinking?
So no, I'm not anti-herb or anti-natural approaches. Like, for example, in methane, if you have methane, I guess the question is the breath test positive or not? But if you have methane, you know, allicin or allicin can be effective. There are other therapies. There's other herbal cocktails that are used, for example, the Hopkins cocktail. But the problem is a lot of these aren't tested in double-blind fashion, but they seem to be effective. One of the problems I find with a lot of the herbs is resistance occurs quite quickly. So for example, with methane, I see relapses within weeks. And so I guess the bugs figure it out and find a way to bypass whatever it's doing and then overcome. So I don't know what other people's experience are, but that's what I generally find. But I try those things, of course, in those difficult and challenging cases, which I even did yesterday.
Okay, so it's worth a try, right?
Oh, of course.
Of course. Okay. Say it again.
Oh, patient first.
Patient first. If the nerve damage in the gut, which you showed us those beautiful pictures of, possibly from the vinculin, can that be reversed when you get the bacteria under control, or do you have to get the antibody under control?
No, I mean, this is the big mystery. So when we published the migrating motor complex paper, it's very exciting. We showed that the low MMC is common in people with overgrowth, but there's a little secret section to there. Not secret, it's there, but people don't pay attention to it. If the overgrowth was eradicated at the time we did, so in other words, you had a positive breath test, but by the time we did the migrating motor complex assessment, the patient had eradicated. They took whatever antibiotic and then the breath test is now normal. The migrating motor complex was a little bit better. So even though we know vinculin is damaging, we think that the bacteria, once they start collecting in there, they're keeping it worse. Because look, if you're a bacteria, do you want garbage in the colon or do you want, you know, the In-N-Out burger that's coming down right now? The fresh, good stuff, the easy stuff. Of course, they want to try and maintain and hang on in the small bowel because they're getting the good stuff. So I'm sure there's something they're doing, and we of course have not worked out what that might be. We don't think they're producing CDTB because when we ran with the migrating motor complex gets slightly better, but it's still way damaged. It's not fully recovered.
Let's talk about prokinetics for a second. And what are some of your favorite? Or do you go with the typical ones? What do you think about LDN?
Yeah. So, I mean, I know a lot of people use LDN, and I use it sometimes, but not as much in my clinic. Dr. Razai, my colleague, uses more of it, and he likes it. I tend to use more erythromycin just because of my long experience and effect with that. And again, it's low dose erythromycin. It's 50 milligrams or a quarter of a 250, which is about 62 and a half milligrams, works just brilliantly at night. It will keep it away. It's not going to keep it away indefinitely. I used to love Zelnorm or Tegaserod, but it's off the market. I hear it might be coming back later this year. That would be awesome. There's a drug that we can get, Rezolor. The California law allows physicians to acquire drugs that would benefit patients outside the country. Rezolor is available a lot of places in the world. And I hear that that's coming to the U.S. soon, because that's a really great drug. I love, for gastroparesis, for a lot of different fertility disorders, Rezolor has been working well, and my colleagues in Europe love it. I'm excited to have that in the U.S. officially soon.
That'll be amazing. Okay, we're going to go a little bit faster. Is there a special treatment protocol for those with the bloom, and any special diet advice? And could you define the bloom, please?
So it's overgrowth, the way we define overgrowth, and of course it changes as we start to understand this more and more, but overgrowth we define as, you're supposed to have X number of bacteria in the small bowel, but instead of that, you have 2X or 3X, you have too many bacteria, and we call that overgrowth. In the case of methanogens, because we're not sure it's in the small bowel or not, and I've given you some of that, some patients it might be, but when we measure the methanogens in the stool, they tend to be proportional to the constipation. So we think it's just they're overabundant or blooming, or just species that just is too much, which is the M. smithii. So if it's one species too much, we call it a bloom, as opposed to just the opportunity for everything to grow too much, which is because of the motility that we saw or that we talk about.
And this bloom will be only, where's the location of the bloom, large intestine or small intestine?
Yeah, I'm going to find that out for you. We don't know yet. As I said, some of the studies we've shown that the methanogens are in the small bowel, but we have to correlate that with breath testing. We have correlated breath testing with stool levels of M. smithii, and that correlation is true. So, which is why we're calling it a bloom, because if it's correlating with stool, it's correlating with colon content. We haven't been able to correlate it with small bowel content officially yet.
Okay, I'll quit asking that question. Okay, what about repeated rounds of neomycin and methane, neomycin with rifaximin for SIBO? And people are asking, can a prokinetic treat methane? Remember, a prokinetic is what you do after the treatment to help prevent relapse. But what about neomycin? People have a lot of concern about the toxicity there.
Yeah, so there's a lot of pieces to that question.
I know.
Basically, there's a really nice study that was done by probably the world's guru on food poisoning and gut microbiology before all of the sophisticated molecular stuff came. His name is Dr. Herb DuPont. Very respect him very much. He's in Houston, Texas. But he showed that rifaximin prevents resistant bacteria. And it does so because it gets into the cell and it stops the bugs from producing plasmids, which have these resistant genes on them. So rifaximin may actually mitigate resistance based on what he was seeing in his data and has published. He also suggested that because if you're on rifaximin and it stops these plasmids from replicating and sharing the resistance among bacteria, it may prevent resistance to other antibiotics if given co-administered. So we've actually, when we used to give neomycin, 75% of people would be resistant after the first treatment. So even if it worked, it wouldn't work 75% of the time a second time. Rifaximin, you can give again and again and again, keep working. If you give neomycin with rifaximin, it seems like it works again and again and again also, because I presume, because of what Herb DuPont showed, that rifaximin can prevent resistance to other antibiotics if given together. So I think that might be what's happening, because we can't get away with neomycin over and over again, except unless you give it with rifaximin. But the second part of the question is the neomycin toxicity. So for some reason, we have like a fear that neomycin is toxic. So let me unpack that question, because neomycin is a drug category called aminoglycosides. Aminoglycosides include vancomycin, gentamicin, and neomycin. gentamicin is a drug that was given very commonly in the 1980s for people who had heart infections. So if you have an infection in your heart, you got to get gentamicin intravenously for weeks. And after getting gentamicin intravenously for weeks, people would get hearing loss. And that's called ototoxicity. Auto means ear, toxicity. And so the hearing loss was a concern. Now, neomycin in the 1960s was given for year, 2 years for liver patients with encephalopathy. And if you took neomycin for 2 years straight, you might get hearing loss. But after thousands of patients giving 14 days of neomycin, I've never seen hearing loss in patients. And I'll say one more thing about that, because this is super important. The FDA, when we were doing our double-blind trial with neomycin rifaximin, the FDA wanted us to do hearing tests at the day one before taking drugs. And if anybody had any problem, to repeat the hearing test. Of course, in the IRB and consent form, they say, okay, if you have hearing loss, tell the doctor. And so patients are reading this. First patient comes in the trial. They say after 4 days of the neomycin rifaximin cocktail, they say, I think my hearing's a problem. So we stop the study, we bring them in. 3 days later, they come in, they have a runny nose, they have cough. They basically had a flu, but they didn't know at the time. And then they finished all of that. We did a hearing test again, and the second hearing test was better than the first one. So they could hear better after neomycin.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah, sorry, long answer, right?
No. I'm saying moving on from that. It's the myth.
So the point is that I don't see it in the short treatment. That's the point. Short answer. You told me at the beginning short answers, and I keep giving you long answers.
No, it's great. It's only so I can get to everybody, because I can already feel the walls closing in on me. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, surgery. A lot of people have had surgery. They get the adhesions. What also happens, though, is even, I don't know how long it takes for adhesions to form, but it seems like their digestion gets really wrecked after the surgery. Have you observed that? And do you have any suggestions?
Well, so what I tell patients when they have abdominal surgery is, okay, so, and I'm sorry for being so long-winded, but.
Dr. Pimentel, you can, I'm living in your world. It's our honor. Tell us whatever you want.
Okay.
Take your time.
So if I were to tammer and hammer your finger, it would become swollen. It would hurt. Did I tell you this before?
No, I'm just thinking about my finger and a hammer. It would hurt.
Yeah, you get hurt, right? So you wrap it up and you hug your hand and you don't use the hand for a week and you let it heal. When you do surgery on the bowel, you're hitting the bowel with a hammer. But tomorrow you're eating. The bowel has to work. It's like you have this thumb, but the next day you go and you use a jackhammer and you start doing your construction work again with this damaged thumb. Well, the bowel is all swollen. It's hurting. It doesn't want to work. It wants to rest, but yet it can't. No time. It's got to be active. It's got to be working. And so it takes a long time for the bowel to heal from abdominal surgery, much longer than other organs, because you can't baby it. It's got to be ready to go the next day.
What if it's even like not bowel surgery, but like, you know, you have a cesarean? Would that impact it?
It's the same thing. It's inflammation in the area.
Okay.
Everything's, you know, the bowels, you got a little scar right here, and the bowel's rubbing on it constantly because it's moving things around. So the scar can't, or it's painful. And that's why adhesion forms, because of these kinds of things.
Does taking lovastatin for high cholesterol also decrease your methanogens?
That's a good question. The problem with the drugs that are on the market, so every time a human has touched lovastatin and tried to change the molecule to make it better for cholesterol, it made it worse for methanogens, because we tested all the statins. So anytime they broke the molecule down and did this and did that, so Lipitor and all these other new ones, they don't do anything for methanogens. We tested all those. The other problem is the drugs, the lovastatin drug that you get, regular lovastatin, it's meant and designed to be absorbed by you into your blood. We don't want that either. The problem is you need higher doses of lovastatin in the gut to cover all that bacteria to get the methane down. And you have to design it so that it doesn't get absorbed, so it stays in the gut. And it gets released in a particular way or order to cover and coat the bacteria and the methanogens there. And that's why the regular stuff doesn't work. And that's why we had to get creative with this Syn-10 product, because we had to be able to get higher doses. We had to be able to get it to where the bugs are, and then it's effective.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit, because we've been really talking about, you know, this background science and all that. Let's talk about ways to prevent food poisoning.
I love it. Let's do that.
Well,
free form answer that.
Yeah. So number one, great tip about Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Great tip about Thanksgiving. Oh yes. You mean the burner under the, yes. I'll say that again, but this is, I shouldn't say this is my idea, because this is Herb DuPont from Texas again. He used to say, if you're going to a wedding buffet, don't eat at the sides of the pan, eat where the burner is, because it's the hottest. The sides of the pan are almost body temperature. They're perfect breeding grounds for bacteria. That's the perfect temperature. So whenever you're eating with, you know, those, I can't remember what the name of them are. Or, you know what they are?
Bunsen burners?
Yeah, well, there's Bunsen burner underneath, but the pans, the whole system is called something.
Oh, chafing dishes.
Chafing dishes, that's it. You always eat from the center of the chafing dish where that hot, hot gas is, because that's where it's above the temperature the bacteria are cooked there. And then, you know, but the point is, if you travel and you travel to places where food poisoning is common, you want to don't eat the salad, don't eat raw stuff, don't eat ice cubes. Ice cubes are used from the local water often, not from filtered or properly prepared bottled water. Drink bottled water, drink beer. Soda is okay, even though soda causes gas and distension. You're not going to get food poisoning from soda or beer or bottled water. Anything that's cooked, anything that comes to your table that's hot, is there's no bacteria in it. If it comes to your table warm, you don't know. It's all about food preparation. So these are, you can't avoid outbreaks. You can't avoid like the romaine lettuce outbreak that comes because somebody didn't use the latrine on the farm where they're picking the romaine lettuce and they put it in the soil because they just went right there because they couldn't make it to the bathroom. You know, then you get this contaminated lettuce. You can't avoid that because you can never know what I'm sorry to be gross and graphic, but that's how these things happen. And ironically, and this is, you know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but the meat industry has done a fantastic job monitoring. But the farm industry has been a little bit problematic because you can't control every person on the field. The bathroom is a mile away, and if you can't make it, you have no choice, you know. And farm industry is a bit different, hard to regulate the security of food poisoning in that industry. I think, you know, I think. Anything else? Sorry. I can keep going about how to travel. Well, and
so, but it also happens here in the States. I think that's the other thing. Like what do you clean your lettuce with at home? Do you put a little hydrogen peroxide, like food grade hydrogen peroxide in the water? What do you do to clean your veggies?
Well, so, you know, you have to, there's something that I tell my patients that I would never say on a video recorded broadcast about which supermarkets are the worst and which are the best, because I don't want to have a lawsuit. But there are supermarkets where the food that they get is grade B. And then there are supermarkets where the food they get is grade A. And there is a difference. And it's a difference in price. You pay more, you get, you know, from better quality farms. I know it's not affordable for everybody, but if you cook your vegetables, you cook your produce, that's not a problem. It doesn't matter. But if you're eating raw stuff, seriously, you get what you pay for, and that's just the way it is. Doesn't have to be beautiful, but it has to be from reputable places. The answer, I don't know anything about farmers markets. I mean, you know, farmers markets are all over the place, and they don't comment. They only comment that this was recalled from this food store.
Right.
It was recalled from that food store. But there are certain food stores that never show up on the list, and there's a reason, because they choose their vendors better. That's just the way it is.
Okay. Okay, I've got a couple of thoughts rolling around here. Oh, this has to do with food spacing. If you brush your teeth and you have toothpaste, obviously, on your toothbrush, Will that stimulate the migrating motor complex?
So that's an amazing question, because I've had that question so many times in my mind and never heard it out loud. And I'm always, to be honest with you, I've always been scared of that question because I don't know how to answer that question. The thing is that if you taste food or sweetness in your mouth, theoretically, it's inhibiting the migrating motor complex because you've now got the oral phase of digestion turning on, which means no MMC. But never tested it. Never tested it. You don't swallow the toothpaste. Hopefully that person doesn't swallow the toothpaste, because that definitely would turn it off. But it's a very interesting question, and I really don't have an answer.
Okay.
Please brush your teeth, though.
Yes. Well, and what if you did like hydrogen peroxide and like baking soda? That's not sweet.
Yeah, that's not sweet. And again, I don't know, but I presume that would be okay.
Do we count the hours from when we finish eating for meal spacing?
Yeah, so studies have shown that it takes roughly 90 minutes to 2 hours to fully digest your food. And that's where we got the 4 to 5 hours from. And it takes roughly 90 minutes to 2 hours after a meal before you start seeing the first migrating motor complexes. So the way we decided on 5 hours was, okay, if you got 90 to 2 hours, so that's 2 hours, you got 3 hours in which to have two migrating motor complexes. So my goal was to increase the chance of having at least one, if not two, migrating motor complexes between each meal by spacing 5 hours. And you have no idea how many times patients have come to my office and said, you know, I started snacking and you're right, I'm worse. Or I decided not to listen to you and I had this particular food item just at one time and you're right, I got worse, I got bloated. And so we think the diet that we use is very effective and not too cumbersome. And in the way we structure the fasting, we think it's really important.
Okay. All right. Fiber. How much is too much fiber? You're talking about a low fiber diet. Can we say a low fiber diet is also a low fermentable diet?
Right. Well, fiber is fermentable. So right. Okay. Less fiber, less fermentation products. Of course, there's other things that are fermentable. But the low fiber, I would say 20 to 30 grams of fiber a day would be low fiber. You don't want to go zero fiber, because you just basically cut out so many different food items, so many different boxed foods or processed foods that are out there that contain that degree of fiber, and then you'd be driving yourself crazy. My goal, as I've said from the beginning, is give patients the feeling that they're human, not the feeling that they have to go to a restaurant, embarrass themselves or feel uncomfortable by, you know, the people around them watching them ask the waiter or waitress 10 different questions before they can order their meal, and they feel embarrassed about all of that. I want the diet to be such that you can go to any restaurant in this country and you'll find something on there and not have to declare to the waiter or waitress that you have a problem and that you have to be choose. You can pick and you're done. And to me, that's getting life back.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it? Okay, we have a doctor, DiLorenzo. After a second round of recommended antibiotics, what do you recommend to bring back the intestinal flora? Do you have a preferred method to use after treatment? We've heard mixed approaches, prebiotics, no prebiotics. What about following up with a non-antibiotic type like Otrontil, peppermint? Do you have a preferred method of trying to get that,
yeah,
that terrain back?
I have to say I don't use a lot of Otrontil, but I have a few patients on it. There are people who swear by it in terms of methane. They get a good effect with that. So let's just count that's something that could be used and perhaps safe. To get the flora back, because rifaximin, remember, we studied rifaximin microflora in a bigger study than had ever been published previously to that date. And we showed the rifaximin does not mess up your flora. You don't need to take a probiotic after it. You don't need to regain the flora. You don't need to recalibrate anything, because it doesn't work in the colon. So with rifaximin, I don't feel we need to do that. I've just spent the last couple of weeks reviewing all the papers on probiotics, and I got to tell you, lactobacillus on summation doesn't work. Bifidobacteria doesn't work. The only thing that might have some benefit are cocktails, and each cocktail is different. Some of them work, some of them don't. So I would say if I were to look at the entire balance of the equation, I would say probiotics are not that effective here. And so the natural products like Allicin or Alimed and all of those things we've talked about already in the earlier part of this webcast, I think there's a good merit for those, and we see good effect, but probiotics I haven't been so excited about.
Okay. And then doing the fermented food, just little baby bits at appropriate times.
It's up to the patient. If the patient tolerates it and it's not bothering them, I think it's okay. Now, sometimes fermented food, there's another problem with fermented food that we didn't get into, acid. So like betaine HCl, a lot of the doctors and natural physicians are advocating betaine HCl for patients. You want to make methane go up, give hydrogen. Give them acid. Acid is hydrogen. They produce more methane from acid. So you could be making the situation worse. So you kind of have to know what they have before you start using these things. But a hydrogen person be giving acid will reduce bacterial overgrowth. I think it's possible. But if you put methane, if you take a methane person, you put acid in there, you're going to have more.
Okay. What about insurance companies and rifaximin? Do you have any comments? Or a lot of people that really struggle to do that, to get it?
So what we're finding, this is the latest data that I got from the company that makes rifaximin, is that 98% of insurance companies cover rifaximin, but that's not the whole story. 98% of insurance companies cover at least part of rifaximin. So if you've got a $1,000 bill and the insurance is covering $300 and you have to pay the other $700, that's not covering. That's just partial covering. But I would say that at least in California, if we write it as diarrhea IBS, because that's what it is, the SIBO may be the cause, but the diagnosis is diarrhea IBS, or mixed and diarrhea are the same. And you put that on the label, or meaning as a diagnosis, because that's what it is, you'll get covered. Medicare falls somewhat short, but for the most part, people are getting almost 90% coverage. And I mean 90% of the bill. So we're not getting much problems here in California, and most of the country is okay too, but you have to have the right diagnosis. If you put something like adhesions, you're not going to get covered because that's just...
Well, right. If the insurance company is saying that it's an experimental treatment, maybe the code that was written down on the prescription for it was not...
It's not FDA approved for adhesions. So right. That's the problem.
Okay. Rapid fire here in our final 10, 11 minutes together. Some patients with pelvic pain greatly are aggravated by diarrhea. And they decline to take the lactulose breath test, but the glucose test is said to miss many cases, as you've already addressed. What advice do you have for confirming SIBO diagnosis in these patients or somebody who can't take
the breath test? You mentioned diarrhea, but if it's methane and it's constipation, then you don't need to even give a sugar, just do a breath sample. We think in some patients, if hydrogen sulfide is elevated at baseline, you may not need a breath test either. So, because once it's over that 1.2 on this device, you're positive, whether it's baseline or not. So that one might work also once we have the new machine. But glucose will detect a fair number. I mean, probably 2/3 of overgrowth that's there with lactulose will be detected by glucose. And if they can tolerate it, then it's... The problem is if it's negative. If it's negative, then... But another way approach, which is used by a lot of physicians, is, well, if it smells like SIBO, sounds like SIBO, and looks like SIBO, why not just treat it and see if you get better? Because even if you get a little better with rifaximin, then it probably is SIBO.
Okay. And if a patient is doing the test correctly, but still has really high levels, like 121 that goes to 150... had severe die-off, repeated the breath test, peak was 142. I think Amazon's ringing my doorbell. If a patient is doing the test correctly, what would make these baselines be so high? Could it be just severe overgrowth? Have you seen this before? Would you keep repeating the antibiotic routine?
Well, again, when it's really high, again, it speaks to me like there may be something else going on, such as adhesions to make it so high and so non-responsive to therapy. One thing we didn't talk about is barium studies are done so terribly in most places to look for adhesions. I've gotten so many patients in our clinic where they come in with their barium x-ray and it's one picture with barium everywhere and you can't see anything. Our guys here, they separate every loop of bowel. It's like 24 pictures before they can conclude that there's no adhesions. So even though the other outside center, one picture, they charge the same amount to the patient as us doing 24 pictures and spending a lot of time, you know, you really have to have a good barium test.
And so you really need to interview very carefully the people who are involved with that, right? Okay. Somebody's saying that Medicaid doesn't cover rifaximin. Medicare doesn't.
Medicare covers it very poorly. We've seen that even in California. It depends on the plan. It depends on the supplements. Depends on whether you've supplemented with Blue Cross or not and all of that. It's a little more challenging with Medicare.
And you're not a huge fan of apple cider vinegar, right? Because of the...
I'm not against it. I just, if you have methane, don't take it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. There it is, Teresa. Answered your question there. Could radiation for breast cancer cause adhesions in the abdominal area?
So the answer to that is no, but the problem with radiation, and I have a number of patients over the years who had radiation, for example, for Hodgkin's lymphoma, because lymph nodes can come in the mediastinum or the center of the cavity here. Radiation here could mean radiation of the vagus nerves, which control the motility of the gut. And if you damage the two nerves that come down the neck, down the esophagus, you're going to affect the muscular function of the gut and you'll get overgrowth. So as I say, there's many causes of overgrowth.
Wow. That's big. That's intense. That's intense. So that's why people with traumatic head injuries could also experience SIBO from damage to the vagus nerve?
Yes. Head injuries, radiation for thyroid, radiation for lung cancer, radiation for breast cancer is possible that you can damage the vagus nerve with that radiation. Depending on how it's administered, I mean, you have to administer it to the body, not just the breast.
Let's see. What about Saccharomyces boulardii in terms of a probiotic?
I looked at that. No benefit.
No bueno.
Okay. Well, it's not for SIBO, not for IBS. It may work, for example, for C. diff. It may work for pouchitis. Some people have, like, people who had their colon taken out and they get inflammation. So it has benefits, but not for SIBO, in my opinion.
Okay. Kat, we have talked about that. Did we answer how to regrow the microbiome after treatment? Like with the neomycin, rifaximin?
Yes, we answered that.
Okay, great. So when people are constipated, we have two chronic situations here continually because I'm reading the people's questions that were submitted beforehand as well as people are coming in live. If you are chronically nauseous and chronically constipated, and a lot of constipation people feel like they need fiber, what do you usually tell your patients as not medical advice for us, but as ideas for us to take to our doctors and discuss?
I mean, if you're nauseated, the methane could certainly be a contributor to that. If you're vomiting, methane doesn't contribute to that. So that's, again, suggesting adhesions and other more sinister culprits for the overgrowth. But it's a complicated question, really. I'd have to take a full medical history on that patient to kind of get to the bottom of the nausea. So I'm not going to be able to easily answer that question because it depends is really the answer.
Do you have articles on your website or just check out PubMed? I think.
PubMed has all of my articles. So you just, the good news is there are very few Pimentels out there publishing. It's good to have a uncommon name. Smith, yeah. Not a good idea.
Yeah. Well, it depends. It depends on what you're up to in your life. You want to hide? Use Smith.
Yeah. Don't hide Smith. It's good.
Okay. Yes, Nancy, the answer to your question is yes. A lot of people use magnesium for constipation. How do you feel about that?
I like magnesium. The only caution I give my patients, because I use a lot of it, the only caution I give with milk of magnesia or magnesium is that magnesium, the kidneys can clear magnesium from the blood, but not that fast. So if you go fast, if you take it in faster than your kidneys can clear it, your magnesium in the blood can go up with that. And that can cause heart rhythm problems and weakness and because the muscles are affected by the high magnesium level. So my point of caution is don't take too much of it. Or if you do, you should get your magnesium level checked in the blood.
Okay. Very interesting. I've never heard that before.
Bismuth also, like Pepto-Bismol, and that's not really part of the treatment, although people think bismuth reduces bacteria. Bismuth toxicity causes nerve toxicity. You can get numbness in hands and feet, and bismuth is bad if you take it long term. It's okay for short uses, but not for long term.
Well, a lot of people use the bismuth for not just coating and protecting their stomach with Pepto, but also as part of biofilm, breaking up the biofilm.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there are people who drink a bottle of Pepto every day, and then they come in and they can't feel their hands and feet. it's bad.
That is bad. Okay, hydrogen sulfide, the questions keep coming. What are we doing to treat it? Is there any herbal approach that works?
Stay tuned.
Okay, that's good though, you guys.
Gotta have more things coming, otherwise you'd be bored with me.
I would never be bored with you. None of us are ever bored with you. By the way, guys, since we're wrapping up, feel free to put love into the Q&A area for Dr. Pimentel, and I'd love to hear your aha moments. I will share them with him. I have two final questions. Metronidazole, is that Flagyl?
Right? Flagyl, yes.
Yeah. Is often given for methane SIBO. Have you seen a lot of metronidazole toxicity, meaning metronidazole-induced encephalopathy? With B1 deficiency and malabsorption, malnutrition.
Metronidazole can cause a number of side effects. If you take it long-term, also numb feet and hands because it can cause neuropathy and neurological things. the most common effect of metronidazole is metallic taste in your mouth. The problem with metronidazole toxicity, the nervous system toxicity, occurs if you're taking it again for months and months and months. It doesn't happen in 14 days. So,
okay.
It's cumulative dosing.
Okay. Ox bile, why does ox bile help with constipation?
I don't know.
Okay, we'll move on. So feel free not to answer this one. If somebody's already had the IBS detects test, what's the reasoning behind now doing the new IBS check test? And if you don't want to get into this because it's complicated, that's fine.
Well, stay tuned. I'm happy to give you an answer in a month and then you can pass it on to your viewers.
I would love that very much. I am at 5:59, and as promised, I wanted to wrap on time. I thank you so much, Dr. Pimentel. People are saying nice things about you. They've learned so much in 2 hours. They feel hope. Great stuff. Fantastic presentation. Okay, you have someone who just straight out said, I love you.
Don't tell my wife.
All right. We will look forward to more conversations with you in the future. I do have Dr. Pimentel as part of our SIBO SOS Summit as well, coming out in September. He's also going to be part of our documentary in 2019. And we will pass on this love to you in a form of a document so you can just, you know, look at it on the refrigerator if you're ever feeling frustrated or like it's not going as well as it should.
Yeah, I have a lot of days like that, so I could use the boost. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in, for listening to me babble for 2 hours.
Loved every minute of it. We are going to look forward to more of that in the near future and in 2019. God bless. Thank you, sir.
Bye. Thank you, Bye. Everybody.
Okay, everybody. I have a couple of things. Dr. Pimentel, you can go off into your day. I'm going to keep on with everybody for a few more minutes.
Okay. Leaving meeting. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Okay, I don't know about you guys, but that totally blew my mind. That was amazing. You know how many hours I have interviewed fabulous people? I'm not taking anything away from them. SIBO experts, mind blown. I hope you feel the same way. I worked very hard to get to as many questions as possible, as you saw me hustling here. And I had to get to some of the people who, you know, submitted in advance. I did my very, very best. Usually I get 99% of them answered. I would say I did not get 99 today. We also had a shorter session because he could only give us 2 hours. So I would say we got about 85% of them done. If you're participating in the full conference and you didn't get your question answered, you know, we do have 9 other incredible experts who are going to be talking to us over the next 10 days. So go ahead and resubmit the question that you didn't get answered today. You can do that with the JOT form that you've been receiving when you've been registering. If you're like, I don't know who should answer this question, Siobhan, then send it to info@sibosos.com, and Karen will sit with me and we'll figure it out. And if I don't know, I'll ask Dr. Seebecker of who would be best to answer your question. Please keep in mind, some questions simply cannot be answered unless you're in a doctor's office. But you know, we work really, really hard to get as many of your questions answered. I hope you sense that and know that. I know it's frustrating when I can't get to everything, and it's got that burningness to that question. I've had it too, believe me. But I hope you also realize how hard we're working to help everybody. Okay, I wanted to also mention that your words are so heartwarming. I wanted to mention a couple of things. So tomorrow, if you have participated in the full conference, we have Steven Sandberg Lewis. Now, I want to just tell you something about him. He has been he's a naturopath, and he's been a gastroenterologist naturopath for like 40 years. He has taught Allison Seebecker, Megan Taylor. I mean, the list goes on and on of who this gentleman has taught. He is amazing. Okay. He's a clinician. So whereas Dr. Pimentel has been talking about research and everything like that, and it's been amazing, and he is a clinician, we call him SSL, Steven Sandberg Lewis, is an astonishingly strong clinician. So we're going to have him. He's going to be talking about GERD. I know we have questions about GERD. He's going to be talking about NERD. I'll tell you what that means tomorrow. We're going to be talking about homeopathy. He is a master homeopathist. There's another word for it. I'm sorry. I can't remember it right now. But even if you're not able to be there and you're like, oh, I don't know, I'll get to it, watch his recording. Because remember, everybody's getting the recording. If you, for whatever sessions you've bought, if you want to sign up for the rest of the conference, you can. We'll apply whatever you spent today, the $59 on the single session, towards your other purchase. Sorry, Karen, I know that is a customer service nightmare, but of course, you know, we always really try to work with you and try to make our customer service primo, because I'm just trying to treat everybody how I would like to be treated, and I'm doing my best. We all are here. The sincerity is through the roof. Sometimes we can't deliver, but you know, that's me feeling guilty is why I'm over explaining that. Okay. We also have, later on in the week, we do have Dr. Bill Salt coming up. If you do not know what is wrong with you, if you are trying to figure out if it's not SIBO, then what? Please listen to Dr. Bill Salt's presentation. He has a very systematic approach that Dr. Seebecker is totally excited about to help you figure out what else it could be. He joined us today, which was fantastic, and had some great questions. But I want you to really learn from him as well. He's a gastroenterologist. You heard Dr. Pimentel refer to him, who has gone more of a functional approach and is fascinating. Who else do we have coming up this weekend? We have I'm just going to count them out. Amy Kapadia. If you even think you have mold toxicity, I sat with her in Portland interviewing her for the documentary and the upcoming summit for an hour talking about mold. My mind was blown there. If you signed up for the entire session, the entire conference, you will get the bonus session with Dr. Tom Messenger. Most of us don't think we have Lyme. Okay. I'll say it till I'm blue in the face. He is the one who convinced me to get the test. And he is the one who helped me understand that I do have Lyme, and that it is absolutely an underlying cause of SIBO. So I have post-infectious IBS. I have Lyme. So I got all kinds of fun stuff going on. But I promise you, it's going to be an amazing session. He also wants you to go to Dr. Horowitz on the web and look up his questionnaire. And Karen, if you can hear me, can you just make sure we include the questionnaire link with the email reminder about the bonus sessions? Because then you'll take this questionnaire and you'll be able to figure out if you might have Lyme or if you probably have Lyme. It's a very famous questionnaire. So I want you to know about that. Dr. Alana Guggenheim. This is someone who Dr. C. Becker was in a conference listening to Dr. Alana Guggenheim, and Allison told me that she wanted to call me during the session because she said, Siobhan, I think this woman is going to get to the bottom of your health issues. Now, that's a big statement for Dr. C. Becker to say about me. I'm very grateful that she's taken my case on with so much enthusiasm, but that's how brilliant she feels that Dr. Alana Guggenheim is. So if you have Ehlers-Danlos, if you have flexibility, if you have, if you're a woman and you feel like, gosh, I get everything, hormones, gallbladder, you really should come to that one as well. Listen to it. And then we have Dr. Greg Nye, who is going to be talking about sulfur, okay? The sulfur pathways. So he's going to be taking an entirely different approach to hydrogen sulfide. I've had an appointment with Dr. Nye, and after I talked to him for my appointment, I don't know, it was about a year and a half now ago, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to tell everyone about him. And I did, but now I'm really telling everyone about him because he is such a different thought pattern and is fascinating and will make you rethink things that you thought you already knew. And if you think you've ever had hydrogen sulfide or if you're even it's on your radar, you need to listen to what he has to say because it was wild. I mean, it's out there. But it's really, really interesting and could be, he's got some quick fixes for you too. Then we also have Maria Zilka. Maria Zilka is a nutritionist in Dr. Greg Nye's office. They're in Portland. And she is going to, as a bonus, if you purchase the entire conference, she's going to be teaching a masterclass on sulfur and diet, what to eat to help you reduce your sulfur load. And again, I didn't think I had sulfur issues. I get all the good stuff. It's really, really fascinating. Hydrogen sulfide, you might be thinking about looking to this diet to help you as well. And she is also skilled in a SIBO diet and low FODMAP. Then Dr. Gary Weiner, he just presented at the one of the SIBO symposiums at the one in Portland and at the school there. And he did a presentation on the connection between the thyroid and SIBO. And how imbalanced thyroid is an underlying cause of SIBO, right? Yeah. So I know my mind was blown with that too. And it was a fantastic, fantastic presentation. Dr. C. Becker was raving about that after she saw that. Also, I feel like I'm forgetting somebody. Karen, am I forgetting somebody? What time is SSL tomorrow? Well, just so you know, I've gone and asked my team to check every presenter's time zone and time that they will be presenting. I believe, and it's been in all the literature, that it is 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern time. So that is truly what I think. If there's a change, if that's not right, we will send you an email, believe me, because it's obviously freaking me out. So I don't know what you're saying, Karen, about that. I just need to confirm. We are confirming time, but I have it written down from 4 to 7 East Coast time. Okay, I think that's what Karen is saying to me on my little phone here. I wanted to also share with you, and I think I'm going to email it to you because I think this is a really long session. And remember, all those other sessions are, you know, 3 hours. This one was two, but I know we had the little hiccup. Dr. Rachel Fresco is the product developer for biobotanicals, Biocidin. Have you heard of this? She was an herbalist and just doing her thing. And she had Commonwealth Labs, when they were doing their GI stool tests, reach out to her. This is way back, saying, what is in this formula? Because when they put the formula on the stool, it was killing all the pathogens in the stool. So Biocidin started her company, Biobotanicals. And she has created toothpaste, mouthwash now, all kinds of great things in this line, including a whole protocol for SIBO. She is one of our sponsors. I have a 10-minute presentation that I did with her that I wanted to share with you. I'm going to play it now and you can watch it now, but I'll also email it to you. It was very, very interesting. And, you know, I tend to get a little bit jaded about supplements because I feel like I've been there, done that, taken them all. But things that she was saying to me really, really impressed me. So I'm going to wrap with that. If you want to stick around and watch that, you're welcome, everybody. And Karen's a big fan of her, of Rachel Fresco's products as well. I'm going to find that video and play it. And if you want to watch it, great. If not, I'll pop it into an email to you. And I do hope that you will watch it because I think it's particularly excellent and it might get you into a nice routine because she has things that sort of all take care of the different issues with typical SIBO. If you're looking for an herbal alternative, what did I do with that? Okay. All right. You don't need to stay, but if you want to, I'm going to show you that right now. I think it'd be kind of a nice way to wrap up. And when I do send it to you an email, I do hope that you will watch it because I think it'd be extremely, extremely helpful if I can find it right now. All right. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow. And if you want to come, but you hadn't signed up previously, feel free to reach out to info@SIBOSOS and Karen will hook you up and get you situated. Okay, so we do this. Hi everybody, Siobhan Sarna here with SIBOSOS.com, with the IBS and SIBOSOS Summit, the SIBOSOS Summits. I'm here with Dr. Rachel Fresco, and she has an amazing backstory, as well as incredibly helpful series of products for all of us. She's the founder and chief formulator of Biobotanical Research, located on the west coast of the U.S. and California. Her company's got its claim to fame when Great Smoky's Diagnostic Labs, now Genova Diagnostics, which is fairly famous here in the States, contacted Rachel to ask if biocidin could be used as a candidate treatment option on the comprehensive digestive stool analysis. As the test results on all yeast and bacterial types showed a very strong broad spectrum activity, as in it was killing all of these pathogens. Since that time, it has become a standard amongst integrative functional medical doctors and practitioners looking to support their patients in GI health and also helping people with systemic infections. So I've been using the entire comprehensive cleansing program with incredible results. I totally believe in this line. I love the new toothpaste. She's got a new dental rinse as well. If you have dental issues, if you have root canals, it's something that you really need to be paying attention to. And she has a potential helpmate for you in that. And so I would love it if you would take a few minutes, Dr. Fresco, to talk to us more about biocidin, GI detox, ProFlora 4R, and other formulas. We've been talking about mold. We've been talking about IBS, dysbiosis, the immune system. So take us through this because your products are so potent, so different, and so ultimately effective.
Thank you. I've been very happy to be able to help so many people over the last 28 years. I love the feedback we get. So the biocidin started out as this liquid formula, and it's very, very strong. You start with one drop, and you work up to, you know, three or four drops three times a day. So this is not like a tincture from the health food store that you take a dropper full. You can really get die off if you don't know what that is. It's as you're breaking down the biofilms and killing the pathogens, you might your body has to detox those remnants. And so it's really important to go very slowly with this, start slowly, and to use this GI detox in between meals on an empty stomach to help mop up those toxins that you're breaking down. What we found with SIBO is that the biocidin alone was able to reduce the levels of hydrogen producing bacteria by 50% without a change in diet and without any other supplements. So if you do your proper SIBO diet and you use this and then you combine it with the olivirex, which is the one that seems to be helping as a support against the methane producing bacteria. So these two are kind of a 1-2 punch. And in fact, not just in SIBO, but if I get a cold or flu, I use these both together. If I have a bladder infection, I use these both together because I think you get like a broader activity with the olive leaf and all of the antimicrobial botanicals that are in the biocidin. So those are the two that are sort of the standard for whatever you're addressing if you think that there is a microbial component to it or mold. For mold, a lot of times too, you can use the liposomal version of the biocidin, and that bypasses the gut and goes systemically. And either of the biocidins can be used in a nasal wash. And on our website at biocidin.com, there's a FAQ. You can read about some of these things and how to use them. The other one that I'm super excited about and proud of that we came out with this last year is the ProFlora 4R. So this is a spore-based probiotic. The spore formers don't have any susceptibility to temperature, acid, antibiotics. So they can get down into your gut and really proliferate. And they have immune modulatory and antimicrobial effects all of their own. And then we added 170 times more powerful type of quercetin. So this quercetin will help with mast cell response and histamine reaction and really help people feel more comfortable as they go through this process. We also added marshmallow and aloe, and those are great, as you know, for healing the gut lining and as a prokinetic for gut motility, which sometimes is an issue for people with SIBO. Dr. Jill Carnahan did some research on the GI detox and found that it was very effective in mycotoxins in before and after lab tests that she was running on the Trichosa things with companies like Real Time Labs. So this is always helpful as a support. And you mentioned the oral products. And I think that's really important because if you have bacteria that you're constantly swallowing and seeding your gut with, right, that's not helping. So we took the biocidin liposomal and we added the quercetin, CoQ10, clove, and myrrh. And this is kind of a souped up dental formula that'll help combat the plaque, combat the biofilms in the mouth, and reduce inflammation in the mouth. And we also put the biocidin in a nice toothpaste. And this toothpaste is great because you can use it every day. It's got almost an ounce of biocidin in this bottle. And I have found this to be much more effective for me than any other toothpaste I had used. By the end of the day, you don't feel like anything forming on your teeth, like, oh, my teeth are getting dirty, I need to brush them again. They still feel clean. So that's a good sign that you're breaking the biofilms. And the dentist have told me that the combination of these two has dropped people's pockets in half in 6 weeks. So that's important if you're trying to take care of your gum health. You know, when you visit the hygienist, they're going to tell you those numbers, right? And you don't want to see fours and fives, you know, so you want to get those numbers down. So that's super helpful. And what else? I think our whole protocol works well together. If you get the comprehensive kit like you're using, Siobhan, you get the biocidin and the olivirex and the GI detox, the ProFlora, as well as a free toothpaste. And you also get the biotonic. And I haven't talked about that, but this is a Chinese herb formula that's super supportive to the immune system. It helps you to have more energy. It helps combat bloating, which is very important in SIBO. And it supports the adrenals. So this comes in the kit as well as an extra support. So that's what I recommend. I recommend that you work with your practitioner or your doctor with these and let them know that you're interested in taking them. If they haven't heard about them, we're happy to help them get on board as a practitioner.
And if you need to just go directly to you, the name of your website one more time?
It's biocidin.com. That's biocidin.com. And for those of you in the SIBO SOS community, just put in SOS as the code and you'll get free shipping on your order.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And you have other things on the website too, some other products that we haven't even had a chance to talk about. So you guys can-
Mostly this is the core of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And for your listeners who are mostly concerned about SIBO, I say if nothing else, just at least get on the biocidin, the olivirex, and the GI detox. Like those are like the three must-haves. And then the ProFlora, I'd say it's pretty must-have too. That's why I put it in the kit altogether. But that's a good start. And if you go for like 8 weeks and then reevaluate, if you're careful with your diet and you do this along with anything else that your practitioner has recommended, you'll see a huge, huge improvement. We saw 70 to 100% symptoms completely gone in 8 weeks. So that's big. But some people you need to continue, like you need to continue on a maintenance for this. It might be 6 months to totally get through everything that's, you know, it could be years that you've had these conditions. So you can't expect that it's going to go away in 3 weeks. You know, it's going to be a process, but you should see a tremendous improvement on your lab tests and how you're feeling at 8 weeks.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Tell me one more time, the one box, because I know it's like a comprehensive kit. How long does that last?
So if you're using the moderate level, it would last 2 months. So you're getting two bottles of Biocidin and then three bottles of GI Detox and all of Virex. You're getting the Biotonic for a 2 month supply and you're getting the toothpaste. So that should put you together for 2 months. If you're doing it more slowly, it could last you even longer. So if you get your first kit, say that lasts you 2 to 3 months, and then you get another kit and you're only using it at maintenance, that's going to last you, you know, twice that long. So now you're in two kits, you've probably gotten through 6 months. And you're probably feeling real good at that time.
And do you ship internationally, Rachel?
We have distributors internationally. So we have a distributor in Europe, Pro Supplements. We have distributors in Korea, China, New Zealand, and Australia. And if you go to our website, you'll see the international distributors and you'll see where to get them. In Canada right now, we have a distributor who's drop shipping to the patients. And we're just about through the process to get our MPN number so we can ship directly to Canada.
Perfect. We really appreciate you. Thank you. Keep up the great work and we'll keep you posted about all the great progress everybody's having from the products.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care, Siobhan.
You too.